DNA.
So when they start to play and you want to know and you can't find the call on the radio, call the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
Just one click to hear it all.
Boba, boba, bloody bow.
Hello and welcome to White Line Wireless's Australian Imperial Force 11 series. This is a podcast series where we tell you the history of the Australian Imperial Force 11 as seen through the eyes of a fictional journalist, Cal Corner, in his letters home each week. However, as you will know from last week, our boys are on a boat right now and you can't send letters home from a boat. So what I've decided to fill these weeks with, because obviously there is a lack of raw material for me to make my constructed letters as I have been doing, is to the next 3 weeks while we're on the boat, we're going to look at some of the social movements going on in 1919 Europe and Australia. Two social movements and the Treaty of Versailles. So what we're going to do in these few weeks that we're on the boat is we're going to have an in-depth look at the Treaty of Versailles, as well as the women's suffrage movement and the labour movement as they're going on in 1919. So a big part of this series and the reason why I've been using these diaries is to help you connect with these players on an emotional level and to see them as humans. However, one of the things that makes that emotional connection difficult is to understand where they are coming from as a person in their own context. And so these are things that will go on to be very important in 20th century history, which may not have been that obvious how important they were going to be at that time, but would definitely have been around. I've also got another shake-up this week in that with me in the Box of Dreams is not one of our White Line Wireless cricket commentators. It is a fellow historian friend of mine, Oliver Murray. Hello, Ola. Ollie, how are you going? And as I said, yep, Ollie is likewise on this path of historian that I am. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at these different topics over the next few weeks from the historian's eye. And so there'll be a bit of theory around how we read different things in history, and I'll go into that in a little bit more detail in other weeks. But we're also being a bit slack, and to save myself on a mountain of preparation for these weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to start off by reading some Wikipedia pages. And I know I might hear some outrage out there at reading off Wikipedia, but as a historian who does this for a living, it's actually not a bad place to go to things first. You never finish your research at Wikipedia, but it's often not a bad place to start. And if you want to get a general overview of events like we want to do today, it's a pretty good reference. So I should also say that neither Ollie nor myself are real experts in this field.
No.
What are your historical interests?
I'm mostly focused on ancient Greece and Rome. That's been my field.
Okay, so that will be very relevant to us today. Actually, it will be pretty relevant because what we're seeing in the Treaty of Versailles, it's sort of a culmination or a step along of that humanist movement that's come out of the Enlightenment, that came out of that sort of Renaissance and the rediscovery of.
Definitely got that that feeling of a continuation of that, the humanist expressions of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, and so it is part of a big, a much longer history. So for us in this series, it's September 1919 right now. So we're nearly a year after the signing of the armistice. And the Treaty of Versailles was signed on the 28th of June. And we mentioned that when it happened in the series. But what we'll do is we might jump straight in. We'll read a Wikipedia page to you and give us some context on how that applies to our cricketers, but also some of the other things around. So are you ready, Ollie?
I am.
Ready, steady, let us go. The Treaty of Versailles was the most important of the peace treaties that brought World War I to an end. The treaty ended the state of war between Germany and the Allied powers. Signed on 28th of June 1919 in Versailles, exactly 5 years after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which had led directly to the war, which, you know, I find that's quite cute, right on the five-year anniversary. The other central powers on the German side signed separate treaties. And I think this is something that gets lost a lot, that by the time the Germans are brought to heel, everyone else had sort of pulled out already. The Russians obviously long gone, and Austria-Hungary had pulled out about a week before. And
yeah, I think the Turkish forces had kind of collapsed a little bit before that as well.
Yeah, it's all sort of in the lead up to that. We'll get to that. So although the armistice signed on 11th of November 1918 ended the actual fighting, it took 6 months of Allied negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference to conclude the peace treaty. The treaty was registered by the Secretariat of the League of Nations on 21 October 1919. Of the many provisions in the treaty, one of the most important and controversial required Germany to accept the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage during the war. The other central powers also had these same articles in their treaties. This became known as the War Guilt Clause. So this required Germany to disarm, to make territorial concessions, pay reparations. And so in 1921, the total cost of the reparations was assessed at 132 billion marks, which is about half a trillion US dollars in today's money. At the time, the economist John Maynard Keynes referred to it as a Carthaginian peace. So getting into your wheelhouse there, Ollie. So
yeah, so
why a Carthaginian peace?
So Keynes was pretty adamant that Germany should actually be strengthened and rebuilt as an economic power. He actually foresaw sort of some of the things that you'd see in the 1920s and 30s with the dissatisfaction that Germany had with the peace and just the economic turmoil that it had. So he sort of said that, like, rather than completely weakening Germany, which is what Britain and France absolutely wanted, he thought that they should rebuild it. And so he actually ended up leaving the delegation partway through the negotiations because he just thought that what Lloyd George and the French were really pushing on was just going to end up in chaos. And so the Carthaginian peace is a peace where it's referring to Hannibal, where the Romans would ultimately beat Hannibal, but it would be at a huge cost.
Yeah, so I think it's after the Third Punic War. I think Hannibal's the Second Punic War, I think, and they decide they're sick of fighting Carthaginians. So what we'll do is we'll burn the city and salt the fields.
Yeah, yeah.
So there can never be another Carthage.
It's Carthage delenda est. Never again Carthage.
Yeah, yeah. So Keynes was kind of like, well, you guys are all a bit, you know, Deutschland delenda est, and that is not going to go well because they're. Like, they're right there. They're not going anywhere. It's not 300 BC.
And it turned out to be quite prophetic.
Yeah, and of course, after the Second World War, you have the Marshall Plan, which was essentially what Keynes was on about. So that's Keynes on the one side. Then on the other side, you have Ferdinand Foch, who's one of the French military leaders, and he was all about it's way too lenient. And the French were really, pushing hard for it to be very, very punitive, because obviously they'd suffered the most, but also there is a long history of these two nations going to war over that particular bit of land along the Rhine and Alsace-Lorraine.
Yeah, I mean, even Britain was absolutely after vengeance. David Lloyd George had just won an election, and his campaign included slogans like "Hang the Kaiser."
Yeah. That's a big part of we might save the political ramifications in terms of democracy and monarchies until a little bit more. So the result of these competing and sometimes conflicting goals amongst the victors was a compromise that left no one satisfied, and in particular Germany was neither pacified nor conciliated, nor was it permanently weakened. So the problem is basically they just pissed Germany off, and this is it gets more and more problematic over the 20s and the 30s, and that they put it off, so, and then
something interesting I looked at recently was that when the German Navy, who were currently sort of captive in Scarborough Flow, heard the terms of the treaty, they decided rather than their ships be used by the enemy, they scuttled all their ships.
Yeah, and there's a few. There's also not long after this, there's I think it's just after the signing of the treaty, there's a rebellion amongst the German soldiers, and then the SPD, the Social Democrats in Germany, sort of make an alliance with the military to go and kill all the communists, so that
right.
So it's there's more than.
Hey, goes well.
Yeah, there's more than one issue going on there. But anyway, with the reparations, they end up at the Lausanne Conference of 1932, postponing those reparations. So there's some stuff going on in Germany in 1932, and you know, a lot of people often wonder where does Hitler's popularity comes from. Well, for one thing, he got the reparations stopped. That was a pretty big deal. So although it is often referred to as the Versailles Conference, only the actual signing of the treaty took place at the historic palace. Most of the negotiations were in Paris, with the big four meetings taking place generally at the Quai d'Orsay, which is the French foreign ministry. The big four thing's pretty interesting. We'll get to that in a bit. Okay, so we are now up to the background section on Wikipedia. And obviously the first bit of background is the First World War. So we'll quickly run through the entire history of the First World War as it relates to the Treaty of Versailles. So on the 28th of June 1914, the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria, was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist. Now, I often, in the long stretch of history, Gavrilo Princip, most successful terrorist of all time. he wanted a Serbia.
Yeah.
And he got a Serbia.
I guess. I mean, although the Balkans, took the best part of 60 Balkans years. were still pretty chaotic, like afterwards. I mean, yeah. Hungary was split up in all kinds of different ways after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And none of the people who lived in the area were particularly happy with any of the ways that it was divided. Like, you had Czechs and Slavs and all sorts of people just like divided up really chaotically. I mean, he definitely, like, if you look at like what he did leading into the Soviet Revolution and then, you know, him actually getting his aims, I think, yeah, like, as far as actually like terrorism for political ends go, I'd say you have to say that it was pretty effective. I mean, considering what a clusterfuck the assassination was, especially, I mean...
which we have talked about on this podcast previously.
Like the whole sort of, you know...
Stopping for the sandwich.
Yeah, stopping for the sandwich and then, like, looking up and, oh, look, it's the Archduke. Okay, yeah. Well.
Okay, so that caused the July crisis, resulting in Austria-Hungary declaring war on Serbia, which quickly followed by most of the European powers into the First World War. When I teach this to Year 7s, I make them all stand on opposite sides of the room, linking arms. They all get to be a country and they all link arms. And the link arm is an alliance.
Yep.
And so, like, at the start, you've got, like, Belgium standing on their own. But Belgium's very quickly drawn in. But you... Because what happens is allies start declaring war on allies.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So in terms of understanding the First World War and why it came about and why, you know, the political consequences of how it... political setup of how it came about, there's nothing that's quite as powerful as seeing a room full of 20, 12 and 13 year olds dragging themselves around. And, you know, obviously a couple of the boys start really getting into it and really sort of going to town on their their opponents. And I've had a principal walk in during that lesson once. And
nice.
When I was explaining to him afterwards what was going on, he was quite supportive of it, but it did look like chaos at the start.
Well, I guess you could say the European diplomatic scene at the time was equally chaotic.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, 2012-year-olds, it's a good representation of European diplomacy in 1914. I won't go into it too deep here, but a big part of this project is going to be building up to the point where how sort of that Victorian identity was just no longer tenable. You know, this gentlemanly class of aristocrats, and
yeah,
you know, the racial superiority and the class superiority and the gender superiority. It's just no longer tenable by 1914. But anyway, so other countries entered as fighting raged widely across Europe, as well as the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. In 1917, two revolutions occurred within the Russian Empire. The new Bolshevik government under Vladimir Lenin in March 1918 signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk that was highly favourable to Germany. Sensing victory before American armies could be ready, Germany now shifted force to the Western Front and tried to overwhelm the Allies. It failed. Instead, the Allies won decisively on the battlefield and forced an armistice.
So the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk is a really interesting point, considering it came not too long before the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah.
And the Germans, like, you know, rightly so, were sort of complaining about the harshness of the Versailles Treaty, but it was really low key compared to what was demanded in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk.
Yeah, so it's not the very next part of the Wikipedia page, but I was going to jump to it next because it's worth having a look at the actual factual specifics here. So after the Central Powers launched Operation Faustschlag on the Eastern Front, the new Soviet government in Russia signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with Germany. This treaty ended the war between Russia and the Central Powers and annexed 1 square mile, which is 3.4 million square kilometers in normal person language, of territory and 62 million people. So this is a third of the Russian population, a quarter of its territory, a third of its arable land, three quarters of its coal and iron, a third of its factories, and a quarter of its railroads.
Yeah, so nothing obscene there at all.
And so you can see how this becomes an issue
in the Second
World War. And why, you know, Russia and Germany really need to fight over that central bit, which was, we won't go too much into Second World War history, but all knowing is that basically Russia's kind of like Australia, which Australia is a desert with some stuff on the edge.
Yeah, and you know, Germany Russia kind of gets all of that in this treaty.
Yeah, and Russia is basically an ice field with some stuff on the edge, and they had to give that all up so that the communists could fix their own internal problems. So the US entry and the 14 points. It's worth going back to this. So you've got to remember the US don't come in until April 1917. So the motives were twofold. So submarine warfare, which led to the sinking of the Lusitania, which there were Americans on. So it's a British ship, but it's full of Americans, and they weren't very happy with the sinking of American lives. And the interception of the German Zimmermann telegram urging Mexico to declare war against the United States. The American war aim was to detach the war from nationalistic disputes and ambitions after the Bolshevik disclosure of secret treaties between the Allies. The existence of these treaties tended to discredit Allied claims that Germany was the sole power with aggressive ambitions. And I didn't know a whole lot about these treaties beforehand, but they'll actually come out in our podcast on the Red Flag Riots. So in January 1918, Woodrow Wilson, the US president, issued the nation's post-war goals, the 14 points. It outlined a policy of free trade, open agreements, and democracy. While the term was not used, self-determination was assumed. It called for the end to the war, international disarmament, the withdrawal of the Central Powers from occupied territories, the creation of a Polish state, redrawing of Europe's borders along ethnic lines, the formation of a League of Nations to guarantee the political independence and territorial integrity of all states. That's important. That was the point of the League of Nations. And we've spoken about Ireland's involvement in these negotiations. Now, Ireland was very much trying to push membership in the League of Nations because they're in the middle of their War of Independence.
Yeah.
And if they had been recognised by the League of Nations, then everyone in the League of Nations would have had to go to war with Britain.
Interestingly, with the League of Nations, the other thing was that a lot of commentators thought that were the League of Nations to be adopted, it would be a way at least to wind back some of the harshness of the Versailles Treaty that Wilson really, really pushed for the League of Nations above any of the other 14 points, because he really thought that it could be used as a way of adjusting things later.
Yeah, and it's also important to not cast Wilson here as some enlightened you know, hero for all man who believes that all people can properly manage their own affairs.
Although David Lloyd George did liken him to Jesus.
Oh, really? Yeah, there you go. There you go. I mean, by 1920 standards, he was quite progressive on a lot of things. But even by 1920 standards, he was pretty racist.
Yeah.
So, it's not as simple as him just coming and saying everyone should be able to run themselves. Because I think the really important thing that you have to keep in mind here from a big context kind of thing is, this is the end of empire.
Yeah.
That's what is over here. Yes, we get another 50 years before the full decolonization movement, but this really is the end of empire. It's at the end of the war that they've realized, because they're all sort of going so national determination and stuff, they've all realized the hypocrisy that's inherent in having colonies. But they do come up with a solution to that, which we'll talk to later in Mandates. But I think that's the thing that, in terms of getting into the mind of a person in 1919, you have to remember, we're on this boat, we're sailing home from Europe, we're not going to get any news for 3 weeks. And so we might be reflecting about how the world has changed since we left Australia. And one of the ways in the world has changed is that the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire, and the German Empire no longer exist. And that is a massive chunk of the world.
Yeah.
That is now in political vacuum, which no one knows where it's going. Okay. All right. We'll jump back to Wikipedia, talking about the armistice. So during the autumn of 1918, the Central Powers began to collapse. Desertion rates within the German army began to increase, and civilian strikes drastically reduced war production. On the Western Front, the Allied forces launched the 100 Days Offensive and decisively defeated the German Western armies. Sailors of the Imperial German Navy at Kiel mutinied, which prompted uprisings in Germany, which became known as the German Revolution, which is what I was referring to before. The German government tried to obtain a peace settlement based on the 14 points and maintained it was on the basis of this that they surrendered. Following negotiations, the Allied powers and Germany signed an armistice, which came into effect on 11th of November, while German forces were still positioned in France and Belgium.
So that 14 points thing, that the German armistice was really based on this idea of the 14 points, was because they really thought that was the best deal they were going to get. That was the best outcome that they had. And so when Wilson, in his sort of urge to get the League of Nations going, like conceded a whole lot of those points, they were really dismayed. They were really, really upset because that was the whole sort of reason they stopped. Because, you know, they still had like 9 million troops in the field.
Yeah. Well, and what you're hinting at there is one of the origins of the stabbed in the back theory, which is, you know, gains popularity in Germany in 1920s. And the other kernel that's sort of in here as well is that foreign troops only entered Germany twice during the First World War. So if you were a German living in Germany, the fact that you just lost the war might have come as a bit of a surprise. Because although, like, food was running out, fuel was running out.
Yeah, the blockade was incredibly effective.
Yeah, so you knew that you were struggling, but the enemy had not been able to break your lines at all. And so this idea during the 20s and 30s gained popularity, that it was, you know, subversive elements within the population, mainly
communists and Jews,
right? And so which get merged together. This is where you get the start of what becomes known as Judeo-Bolshevism, which has now become, in English in the 21st century, cultural Marxism. So just FYI, if you're one of those people who likes to shout cultural Marxist, just know that you're using a Nazi slogan there. And that's where it comes from. And it means nothing other than basically the Jews are all communists and they're trying to take over the world secretly. All right. So we've signed the armistice. The the evacuation of German troops from Belgium, France, and Luxembourg goes on, and it establishes that the Allied forces will occupy the Rhineland. And the Rhineland's really important because that's where all the coal and steel kind of is.
And it's Germany's industrial center.
It is, and it's also, the Rhine is obviously, that's the highway, how you get stuff out of Germany, because the Rhine goes to what's the port in the north? So the Rhine, flows through the industrial heart of Germany and out to the sea through the Netherlands at Rotterdam. Okay, the blockade, which we just briefly mentioned, but both German Empire and Great Britain were dependent on imports of food and raw materials, primarily from the Americas, which had to be shipped across the Atlantic Ocean. The blockade of Germany was a naval operation conducted by the Allied powers to stop the supply of raw materials and foodstuffs reaching the Central Powers. The German Kaiserliche Marine was mainly restricted to the German Bight and used commerce, raiders, and unrestricted submarine warfare for a counter-blockade. The German Board of Public Health in December 1918 stated that 750,000 German citizens had died during the Allied blockade, although an academic study in 1928 put the death toll at 424,000. A lot of people. All right, so guns have fallen silent. We don't have peace yet. We've got an armistice. We need to start negotiating. Talks between the Allies to establish a common negotiating position started in January 1919 in the Salle de Lahore. That's nothing. Pronounce nothing like that. But I find with French, what you do is you just you swallow all your words and don't pronounce anything. So the French Foreign Ministry. Initially, 70 delegates from 27 nations participated in the negotiation. Russia was excluded because they signed a separate peace treaty. And the Germans were excluded as well, as so that they couldn't divide the Allies diplomatically.
I think most of the Central Powers were basically kept out of any negotiations. I mean, for Germany, it was supposed to be a dictated peace. Mm. They weren't allowed any say in it.
Yeah. Right, so you've got these 27 nations. They then go down to a council of 10, which is two delegates from Britain, France, the US, Italy, and Japan. And they get together to formally decide the peace terms. This was replaced by the Council of Five, which is just the foreign ministers from each of those, which is Prime Minister of France, Georges Clemenceau, Prime Minister of Italy, Vittorio Orlando.
Clemenceau.
Huh?
Clemenceau.
David Lloyd George from the UK, who we've spoken about, and Woodrow Wilson, which we have also spoken about. So interestingly, they get called the Big Four.
So Japan disappears, and then we've still got the Italian Orlando.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to point out. So we've very quickly gotten down, and Japan have been basically isolated here.
Yeah, they were pretty unhappy about that. They thought that they were going to be getting a lot more out of this treaty process than ended up happening. And
because it's all about, national sovereignty, no racist stuff.
Well, interestingly, Japan actually, one of their big sort of pushes was for racial equality.
Yeah.
Which, considering what sort of ends up happening in the Second World War is quite an interesting turn.
Well, and the other thing is that I kind of wanted to have a soundbite that I could just play constantly throughout this podcast of just Billy Hughes just interrupting at inappropriate points and just going, "No Japs." Because that's essentially Australia's contribution to the Treaty of Versailles, was the exclusion of the Japanese. That was the most important thing to Billy Hughes, because obviously because the Japanese want this racial equality stuff to come in. I wouldn't say that's because the Japanese had some great belief in racial equality. It's just that they want to be treated as equal with the Europeans. But Billy Hughes obviously was seeing that if we get to racial equality about things, then we're going to run into some problems with the White Australia policy. And so that's where a lot of Australia's worry is coming out of that.
Well done, Australia.
Yeah, and Yeah, the, people like to say the White Australia policy is the original sin of the Australian Parliament. And it's very racist, don't get me wrong, but it is also coming out of a history of Chinese indentured labour and blackbirding, so which is what we call slavery here in Australia, was the indentured labour or blackbirding. So yeah, because of all of our slaves in Australia were coming from non-white nations, that was a whole part of the White Australia policy, was to stop the slave trade in Australia. But it also was very, 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 very racist.
Pros and cons.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the labour movement's main desire was to not have cheap labour.
Yeah.
And the way that they were able to sell that, particularly with the protectionists, because you've got the labour movement, the free traders and the protectionists, you've got three sort of political poles in Australia at this time. So the way that they're able to sell that with the capitalist groups is you know, obviously the free traders want as much cheap labour as they can get, but the protectionists, they're like, oh, no, like we get it. You're protecting an industry, and so we get it. But yeah, we will talk about what actually is the original sin of Australian democracy in another podcast. Okay, so the Big Four have gotten together. They've had a meeting, 145 meetings, in fact, and they would basically, once a week, so they'd be meeting all the time. Once a week, they'd invite everyone else, all the other nations along, and they would tell them what they had decided. So there is no negotiation here with the rest of the allied nations. It is just the US, France, and the UK by now deciding who does things.
Italy, who kind of got into the war a little bit late and sat on the fence for quite a while, was really expecting to get a whole lot of territory in the Adriatic. And it was just constantly.
Because their deal was, we won't join the Germans.
They were waiting for the best deal. They were negotiating with both sides and like waiting for who basically was going to give them the most amount of territory.
Yeah, and so it's Italy's involvement in the First World War is the final step of the interregimentum or something, the integration Italy, which you know. It has its big point in 1860 when they form Italy, but there were all these Italian places up in the Adriatic and along the sort of the Austrian border and stuff where they were like, that's full of Italians. We should have that. And obviously the Italians are quite keen on this idea that, oh, well, look, we're going to redraw the boundaries of Europe based on what the national identity of the people in the area is. And Italy was like, oh, great. That means we get all of these places, including very important port up in the top of the
gets frustrated, and quite famously the Italian prime minister leader leaves in a really dramatic huff and storms out of the negotiations.
I love a flounce post. So we've got next the French, British and American aims. So let's have a look. What did the French want? French have lost 1.3 million soldiers, which is 25% of men aged 18 to 30. So they suffered. They've been more physical damage than any other nation. The most industrialized region had been devastated. So as the Germans retreated back to Germany, they flooded all of the mines and set fire to like coal pits and basically just trashed the place on the way out. And they knew that they were going to lose this war, and that was what the point was. Yeah, and so Keynes calls this, like we've mentioned before, the French want Germany obliterated back to medieval times.
Yeah, quite interestingly, one of their key war aims was not just demilitarization, but they wanted a creation of an actual brand new state in the Rhineland that would serve as a buffer state, basically a Iron Curtain for France.
Yeah, so using the Rhine as the border, which also, like we mentioned, you know, there's all the but it's also Alsace-Lorraine, which that's the War of 1870 was over that.
That was when France lost all that territory.
Yeah, yeah, which they had gained.
Yeah,
in under Napoleon. So
it's and been going back and forth between Germany and France for a while.
Yeah, yeah. So that region has been going back and forth between the Germanic tribes and the Celtic tribes for probably 5 or 6,000 years. So it's one of those places. and yeah, basically, Clemenceau. What did you call him?
Clemenceau
is saying, you know, America, you've got the Atlantic, England, you've got the Channel.
Yeah,
we need some sort of border against these crazy Germans. And they're going to do this again.
It's interesting the parallels between this and the peace process after World War II, where the Soviet Union was just like, we want a weakened Germany, and we want this buffer between us.
Mm.
If Germany's not weakened, and at that period, the Britain and America were like, no, we want to sort of prop Germany up. And that's kind of why you ended up with the Iron Curtain. Basically, the Soviet Union said, well, we're not giving this land back because we need this buffer zone between Germany and us because we don't want Germany back.
That's something I've been meaning. I don't do a lot of 20th century history, you know. Like, once the First World War's over, I'm kind of done.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of my time done. And so I haven't looked at the end of the Second World War a whole lot. But you know, I was looking at something the other day and yeah, the establishment of like Estonia and Latvia and that just at the end of the Second World War. And I've never really thought about how much of, like, that must have just been no man's land at the end of, at the end of World War II.
It's just crushed.
Yeah, everyone is retreating out. There's power vacuums popping up all over the place. And
well,
yeah,
I mean, all of that area was pretty much full of the Red Army at that stage. I mean, that was really the big sort of impetus for a lot of the negotiations that went on in Europe was that the Red Army was all the way up to Germany, and there was millions of
Berlin.
Them.
Yeah, yeah. okay, so basically, what do the French want? The French want the Germans to be bombed back to
the medieval times. They want them back to
a buffer state and the Saar Valley as well.
Yeah,
which is lots of the
although interestingly, products. Another one of the French aims was the protection of their alcohol regions.
So, I love this. Yep, this
so,
is a great little.
So yeah. They made sure that in the 400 different sort of points that were created in the Versailles Treaty, I think number 275 is the regulation of the right to regional appellations in respect to wine and spirits. And basically what this was that they absolutely wanted cognac and champagne to only be attributable to the regions that they come from.
And yeah, so this is where it all starts.
Yeah.
And so a couple of weeks ago, we're talking on this podcast about how so much of the British Empire is built on its morality and its technology and the superiority of that. And I mentioned that the French Empire was largely based on, you know, superiority of French culture in terms of like philosophy and art. And I think this is really, really, really plays into this because, you know, at the end of just being absolutely destroyed, one of the things that they demand in this new world order is that if these stinky English men want to drink champagne, they can pay a Frenchman. So, but then you're also mentioning, spoiler alert, the US don't end up signing this treaty, by the way.
It's one of the interesting things about this treaty is, you know, that the Americans spend so much effort putting it together and then they don't ratify it themselves. That the really bizarre spin on this is that this protection of regional nomenclature then doesn't translate into the American market, and so California is able to sell bubbly wine as champagne for another few decades.
Yeah, well, up until I think the up until the 90s, I think when the European Union start doing all of that. So Britain, what do Britain want? So they have suffered little land devastation. However, the British wartime coalition was re-elected during the so-called coupon election at the end of 1918 with a policy of squeezing the German till the pips squeak. Public opinion favoured a just peace, which would force Germany to pay reparations and be unable to repeat the aggression of 1914, although those of a liberal and advanced opinion shared Wilson's idea of a peace of reconciliation. In private, Lord George opposed revenge and attempted to compromise between Clemenceau's demands and the 14 points, because Europe would eventually have to reconcile with Germany. Lloyd George wanted terms of reparation that would not cripple the German economy so that Germany would remain a viable economic power and trading partner. By arguing the British war pensions and widows' allowances should be included in the German reparation sum, Lloyd George ensured that a large amount would go to the British Empire. Lloyd George also intended to maintain a European balance of power to thwart a French attempt to establish itself as the dominant European power. A revived Germany would be a counterweight to France and deterrent to Bolshevik Russia. Lloyd George also wanted to neutralize the German Navy to keep the Royal Navy as the greatest power in the world, dismantle the German colonial empire with several of its territorial possessions ceded to Britain and others being established as League of Nations mandates, a position opposed by the Dominions.
So it's really trying to maintain the pre-war status quo.
Absolutely.
British control of the oceans.
Yeah.
British control of most of the world's colonies.
Yeah.
And then the continent just barely able to keep it in each other's throats, but not actually fighting.
They can totally be their own countries, but they're just not ready to run themselves yet. So we will get to mandates. They are horrible. And the other thing I like because up until the First World War, the British had this thing where they based their production of their navy on what everyone else in the world was doing. And so essentially the British Navy had to be bigger than the rest of the navies in the world combined.
It was supposed to be something like five times. The next competition was the minimum level for their naval strength.
Yeah, and more than everyone. So the whole world wouldn't be able to gang up and take the seas off Britain.
It's a lesson the Americans seem to have learnt.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And it's something else I wanted to sort of touch on here with what... So Wilson wants all of these independent states, but we know he didn't think that they were... He's a big racist, so we know that he's looking down on them. But he's also, because it's not just territorial integrity and independence... for national identity, has to come with democracy and free trade.
Well, yes, of course.
And
it was self-determination as long as that determination was democratic.
Well, self-determination as long as that determination was capitalist.
Well, yes.
Which is what that's what he's really saying there, is when it's not democracy, it's got to be democracy and free trade. Because with a democracy in a poor nation with people who you think are idiots, that's going to be very easy to manipulate. And if free trade is built into the very essence of it, then, well...
We can send our American companies there.
This is the thing, is that America hasn't quite worked this out yet, but they are working it out. And they will. It's World War II that really teaches them this lesson, is that you don't need to hold an empire. You need to have corporate headquarters in every nation.
Yeah, it's the start of the neo-colonialist movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so American aims. So prior to American entry, Wilson had talked of a peace without victory. This position fluctuated following the US entry into the war. So, sort of getting into the war saying, well, we just need peace. But then once we're there, it's like, well, we kind of have to win this. Wilson spoke of the German aggressors with whom there could be no compromised peace. However, on 8th of January 1918, Wilson delivered a speech known as the 14 Points that declared the American peace objectives, which is what we have gone through before. So... Wilson brought along top intellectuals as advisors to the American peace delegation, and the overall American position echoed the 14 points.
So one of the interesting things about the delegation that Woodrow Wilson took was that the Republicans had just had a landslide victory in both houses. Now, both houses were now controlled by Republicans. He took no Republican delegates with him.
Right. Yeah, Wilson was really alone on this in the US. It's not even, is Wilson a Democrat?
Yeah.
So it's not even, because the Democrats are almost the more isolationist at that point as well. And you also have to remember American political history, pre-1960s Democrat and Republican mean something
very different
than what it does today. The Democrats didn't. His own party wanted nothing to do with this. And the Republicans, who theoretically should have been closer to being on board with it, were also, the other party.
Yeah, well, it was largely to A, this snub by Wilson by not including any of them in the process, and also his absolute unwillingness to negotiate with the Republican leaders. Like, when discussing the League of Nations, there was these sort of questions of sovereignty and about small nations being able to have power over large nations, and one of the Republican leaders was saying, well, why don't we make the votes in the League of Nations based on sort of the political power of the country?
Mm.
And Wilson wasn't interested in that at all.
No.
He didn't want any kind of, he wanted this like really neutral, all countries are equal. And yeah, it just was not going to fly with any of the Republicans. And yeah, like he just refused to like budge on that. And so that was sort of one of the ultimate reasons why, both the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations just did not get signed on with the American government.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have been obvious at the time because the US wasn't even a world power at the start of the First World War. It's kind of getting there, but it didn't compete with the likes of France and Germany and the UK. And by the end of the war, it did, but I'm not sure that everyone was really aware of that. At that stage. All right. So Wilson also firmly opposed harsh treatment on Germany. So while the British and French largely wanted to annex the German colonial empire, Wilson saw that as a violation of the fundamental principles of justice and human rights on the native populations and favoured them having the right of self-determination via the creation of mandates. So there's another thing that Billy Hughes hated because Australia was getting Papua New Guinea out of this deal. So Papua New Guinea becomes an Australian colony at this point. Until 1975. All right, so I'm just checking up on the Papua New Guinea stuff to make sure it wasn't after the Second World War that it becomes the Australian colony. So 1905, UK transfers its... 1905, so the Dutch have West Papua, the Germans have North, what we think of Papua New Guinea today. Brits have the South. In 1905, the South gets transferred to Australian administration, and then gets the North following the treaty, but it doesn't become a mandate, which, like I keep teasing, we're going to get to. It actually becomes a territorial possession, extra territory of the Australian Commonwealth. So, which means that until 1949, the South and the North of Papua New Guinea are run by separate administrations that are controlled by Australia. Which this is sort of shows where a lot of this craziness of these systems got, you know, well, guys in Europe drawing lines on maps.
You can tell that Europeans have been involved because there's a straight line through the country. And whenever there's a straight line on a map, Europeans have been there.
Absolutely. So Americans want the mandates. So the promoted idea called for major powers to act as disinterested trustees over a region, aiding the native populations until they could govern themselves. I love this peak paternalism.
Yeah,
it is one of the long threads that I'm trying to tease out of the book I'm writing about this tour is. I'm starting right back in the 1850s because I think you need to really get into the mindset of a high Victorian gentleman to really understand what's going on in cricket in 70 years later. Because you really just have to understand this paternalism because it's
the white man's burden.
Well, so even that's oversimplifying it. And I think we really oversimplify when looking at sort of 19th century colonialism, the mindset of the patriarchy. And I think a lot of people in contemporary times give that membership of that patriarchy far too many people, and that it is a very, very, very small selection.
Mm-hmm.
It is the top 1% of society are members of this class that run everything. And I've got some really great stuff that I'm going to put in the book where you have some of these cricket administrators talking about the Aboriginal cricketers in the late 1860s. And like professional cricketers in the late 1860s, and how the Aboriginals are fine, like they're great, like we want them, you know, want them working at the club, and we want them playing for Victoria, and they were outraged about these professionals and that they're not the right kind of man to be playing cricket. And it all comes down to the fact that these Aboriginal people who had, you know, they were still of the generation that saw their genocide. So they can remember being born into a land where there were no white people, and now live in a land where all the white people had killed most of their family. And so they're very good at knowing their place.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Doffing the cap. Yes, sir. No, sir. Three bags full, sir. And so they're really well accepted into the MCC, you know, the Melbourne Cricket Club, which is the snootiest, most elitist institution just about in Australia, especially at that time. And just seeing the way that, you know, like one of the writers just really being really, really critical of some guy who refused to play against them because they were black. And it's like, that's just not on, you know, like we are civilizing these people and cricket is the best way to civilize someone and they have know their place.
Yeah.
And so we need to welcome them. But that professional over there, that Australian born white guy who thinks he can talk to me however he likes, like there's no place for him in this club. Like we need to get
interesting.
Rid of him. And to really appreciate that the racism in colonialism is a paternalism that comes out of this patriarchy that it goes beyond race. I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't racism. I'm not saying they didn't believe in a racial hierarchy, but it's
definitely an acculturation process as well.
Yeah. But you know, like in the racial hierarchy, like Irish people are much closer to Aboriginal people than English people. You know, like they're Irish people are barely human. So, it's just one of those things that I'm trying to get out in the history that I'm doing to be a little bit more complex on these things that we now look back on, you know, after post-colonial history, look back on history, we go, well, that was all pretty bad. But just to make that more complex and to problematize that some of the assumptions that we carry around today on what the 19th century was like. All right, not 100% sure how we got into that, but yes, we're talking about mandates.
The mandate.
Yeah. So in spite of this position of the mandates, this is the US's aims, and in order to ensure that Japan did not refuse to join the League of Nations, Wilson favoured turning over the former German colony of Shandong in eastern China to Japan rather than return it to the Chinese control. So this basically, the Chinese walk out at this point.
Yeah.
So further confounding the Americans was U.S. internal partisan politics. So, yeah, in 1918, the Republican Party won the Senate election by a slim margin. Wilson, a Democrat, refused to include prominent Republicans in the American delegation, making his efforts seem partisan and contributed to a risk of political defeat at home.
A risk that was very soon realized.
Yeah. Yeah. The story of World War One really is. That looks like a bad idea. That looks like it's going to go wrong. And it does.
Yeah.
Like it is the World War One is just a series of obviously bad ideas. Like no one sitting in any position of power should have gone, this will work. It's just obviously a bad idea. But it really reinforces this, the patriarchy that I was just talking about. It's that it's a very small group of people who are very dislocated from the reality of life from most of society, much like we have with people like, you know, George Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and these kind of people.
You definitely get a feel looking at the history of World War One that of all the leaders, shit's just getting away from them. They're like, oh, this is kind of getting a little bit out of control. Oh, shit. Yep, there it goes.
Mm. Yeah, and it's because there's so many norms and assumptions carried into World War One about how the world is and how the world works that aren't true.
No, yeah.
And so that's why this keeps happening is these people are, you know, like things like, oh, well, they'll be easy to beat. They're brown.
Yeah.
No. And, you know, or, you know, we'll be able to just, we'll be in Germany we'll be in Berlin by Christmas because I don't know. Yeah, because you know, for once, it's sort of the first time that England, which had conquered the world behind a Maxim machine gun, was the first time they actually had someone else on the other side.
It's kind of interesting how many assumptions, like even non-mainstream ones, like you had the Second International, which was sort of working towards communism through democracy.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely certain that there wasn't going to, you know, be a world war because the workers wouldn't fight in a capitalist war. And it turned out that a whole lot of people turned out to be a lot more patriotic than they were communist.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting point, and I think that's part of the wider point that's being made in this series of podcasts, is that this really is a period of birth of national identity and class identity that really must be reckoned with. That, you know, the reason why Gallipoli is so important to Australian national identity is because it comes early on in Australian history. But it's because up until the First World War, national identity is just not that big a deal. You know, it is the First World War that gets people to start focusing and realizing, well, hang on, we are this nation of people, and you know, I can motivate you to go to war based on that group identity. Whereas if you go to England in 1860, your village identity is probably more important than your English identity.
Yeah, right.
Except for amongst this real top class,
yes,
of patriarchs up the top, who very much about British identity, and spreading what they consider to be a British identity.
Do you think that it was a sentiment that was sort of manufactured at the top and then brought down to the bottom?
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Most national identity is a program of power.
Right.
This is what makes history in schools such a political football, is because that's one of the main ways you can create a national identity, is through teaching kids the history of the nation.
Yeah.
So what you do in that space is very important into creating national ideals. But you know, it's also the values. Like, one of the things I actually started this thesis, one of the things that I was really looking at was this thing called the imaginary grandstand. And that is the idea that we use our national sports teams as a place to have a discussion about identity and values. And this is why national sports teams are so important. So, for example, the Australian cricket team got busted. A couple of cricketers got busted cheating last year.
Yep.
And the thing they did wrong really was getting caught. Because while they were cheating and winning, they were upholding the value system that Australia cricket had been creating, mm-hmm, and that Australian cricket had been used over the last 20 years as this sort of symbol of Australian dominance, whereas in a lot of its history, Australian cricket is much more about being an underdog than being, you know, the greatest in the world. An even better example, I think the best example to think about this right now, and I'm sorry, Ollie, you'll have no idea here because I'm talking about sport. But in tennis,
I'd even heard of the ball sanding thing.
Yeah, so there you go. So it's made it all the way. There's two tennis players at the moment, Ash Barty and Nick Kyrgios, who have very different media narratives. Now, Ash Barty is Indigenous, and she is very deferential, and you know, she does all the right things, and she, mm-hmm, behaves in all the right way. Exactly what I was just talking about. With like these cricketers 160 years ago. Whereas Nick Kyrgios is a spoilt little dickhead, basically. but he's also very, very harshly criticised. And I think it's interesting to juxtapose the narrative around those two non-white people,
mm-hmm,
in Australian sport, who are in the same sport. And it's very easy to criticise Nick Kyrgios because he deserves a lot of criticism. But it's very easy to also miss what's going on there in a larger racial discussion,
yep,
in Australian society, in that, yes, you know, we're not racist. Come here as long as you know your place.
Yeah.
Which is very much a very much Australian assimilation identity is about knowing your place. All right. So we are getting on, and we haven't even signed a treaty yet. So, in June 1919, the Allies declared the war would resume if the German government did not sign the treaty they had agreed to amongst themselves. So, they've convinced the Germans to stop fighting based on this one lot of things, and then gone into a room and come out with a different lot of things and said, sign this or we are going back to war. And of course, you know, the Germans have retreated and pulled back their lines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so they've really given up the, given up. Yeah, they'd be stuffed. So the government, headed by Philipp Scheidemann, was unable to agree on a common position, and Scheidemann himself resigned rather than agree to sign the treaty. Gustav Bauer, the head of the new government, said in a telegram stating his intention to sign the treaty if certain articles were withdrawn, including Articles 227, 230, and 231. Which I don't think that's the I don't think that's the yeah, that'll be the war guilt stuff. I don't think it's the champagne.
No, no, that's 275.
Yeah, yeah. We're, the Germans are okay with the champagne. They're like, have you tested our wine? We are not going to sell it anywhere. In response, the Allies issued an ultimatum stating that Germany would have to accept the treaty or face an invasion of Allied forces across the Rhine within 24 hours. On 23rd of June, Bauer capitulated and sent a second telegram with a confirmation that a German delegation would arrive shortly to sign the treaty. 28th June 1919, the fifth anniversary of the assassination, the treaty was signed. It had clauses ranging from war crimes, the prohibition of the merging of Austria with Germany without the consent of the League of Nations. So, yeah, a bit of foresight there from someone. Freedom of navigation on major European rivers. And returning of a Quran to the King of Hejaz. That I've never heard about.
No.
Never heard about that one.
So, yeah, like, one interesting thing about the signing was a witness said that the German delegation were, like, they refused to use the enemy's pens or the enemy's ink. They used their own pens.
Yeah.
And a witness said that the delegation was so shaky that they looked like people signing their own death warrants.
Yeah. 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 Well, because they would, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
No choice. You know that you're going to go home and be hated.
And another thing was that Waterman, the Waterman Pen Company,
right,
was extremely proud that it was the provider of all the pens at the Versailles process. And so it had advertising for ages about, like, you know, how it was sort of instrumental in this peace process,
yeah,
which, you know, I think, like, after sort of how it sort of turned out, they might have, like, toned down the advertising a little.
But, you know, Waterman pens, it's a classy pen. It's a, yeah, big event. You know, I can see the natural synergy,
yep,
going on there. That's kind of like what Donald Trump has with Sharpie, which I think is, it's an appropriate, you know, the Waterford is the pen of the high diplomacy,
yes,
of the Treaty, yep, of Versailles. The Sharpie is the pen of the high diplomacy of Donald Trump. Have you heard about that thing he does where he just, like, rips a page out of a magazine and sends it to someone?
No.
Like, so he, there's something, I don't know, rips some page out of a magazine that was having some go at the terms of trade between Canada and the US,
yep,
and just wrote, like, see, and sent it to Justin Trudeau. Like, he's not, like, sending this to, like, random people, like,
yeah,
leaders,
right,
of other countries.
Oh, so, well, you know.
Yep, I don't know. It's
a change from hidden diplomacy.
Oh, mate, I don't know. We're sort of last days of something at the moment. It's quite interesting to live through. All right, territorial changes. So Germany loses 65,000 square kilometers and 7 million people, a lot of which is goes on to be problematic in a few years' time. It also required Germany to give up gains made via Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and grant independence to the protectorates that had been established. So they've got all this, Russia gets out of the war,
yeah,
by giving Germany all this stuff, and then they have to give it all up,
yeah,
and create countries. So in Western Europe, Germany was required to recognize Belgian sovereignty over Moissonnet and to cede control of the Eupen-Malvernay area. Within 6 months of the transfer, Belgium was required to conduct a plebiscite on whether the citizens of the region wanted to remain under Belgian sovereignty or return to German control, communicate the results to the League of Nations, and abide by the League's decision.
That's interesting because, so, Austria, who at that time has just, like, come out of the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they very much wanted to become part of Germany.
Yeah.
And basically France and Britain was like, there is no way we are letting Germany end up being stronger than they were at the start of this. And so basically the whole self-determination thing was just nixed and they became their own country.
Yeah, well, I reckon that's probably, and so that's probably what's going on here is that they're like, well, we'll have this one little bit in Belgium that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's marchland anyway. And not marshland, it's marshland.
Yeah,
it's the land you other armies march over to get to other wars.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, Belgium and the Netherlands. that is their military history, basically, is other countries walking over them to go and fight another country. But yeah, so they're obviously like, well, maybe we'll have this, you know, it's sort of like a fig leaf. And so we'll let this part of Belgium decide if they want to go back to being German. And you know, it's fair for everyone. So
the same sort of deal happens in the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia. Like all the places that basically end up going back to Germany in 39.
Yep. So that's the next paragraph, but we'll get to that in a second. But we've just got here. So, compensate for the destruction of the French coal mines. Germany was to cede the output of the Saar coal mines to France and control of the Saar to the League of Nations for 15 years. So basically, because they flooded all the mines on the way out, they had to give, you know, the Saar Valley output to France and control in an international mandate. The treaty restored the provinces of Alsace-Lorraine to France and was sovereignty of Schleswig-Holstein was to be resolved by a plebiscite held at a future time. And that's the bit up near Denmark, I believe.
Yep.
So that's the bit up near Denmark that's gone, kind of like Alsace-Lorraine, it's gone back and forth between the Danes and the Germans for hundreds and hundreds of years. So in Central Europe, Germany was to recognize the independence of Czechoslovakia and cede parts of the promise to Upper Silesia. Germany had to recognize the independence of Poland and renounce all rights and title over the territory. Portions of Upper Silesia were to be ceded to Poland, with the future of the rest of the province to be decided by plebiscite. So there's this plan to have a heap of votes and have people decide where they're going back. So the border would be fixed with regards to that. So a bunch of other parts go back to Poland. So, they're creating Poland, essentially. Yeah.
You do end up with this bizarre split of Germany where, because Poland is guaranteed access to the North Sea, they create this thing called the Polish Corridor, which goes through Poland, divides a chunk of Germany off from itself, and gives them the port of Danzig.
Yeah. And is this where you get... how you end up with the funky Kronstadt stuff as well. So the Soviet Union had this one little port on the the Baltic Sea that was completely separated from the Soviet Union,
non-contiguous territory.
Kaliningrad.
All right.
Yeah. So in between Lithuania and Poland, there's like this little chunk of land that is actually Russia. And it's just, it's for the Kaliningrad port. Kronstadt was where the sailors had in the revolution, the Bolshevik revolution. They walked over the ice. That's a post-World War II thing, Kaliningrad. So we won't worry about that now. All right. So there you go. So Germany was to cede the city of Danzig and its hinterland, including the delta. Of the river on the Baltic Sea, for the League of Nations to establish the Free City of Danzig. So that was an autonomous state until 1939.
I think there was a few places. Was it run by the League of Nations? There was a few sort of either protectorates mandates or just
places
Jerusalem
like this. Was supposed to be one of those at one point. I think it was a mandate of the United Nations.
Yeah, free city under the League of Nations.
Yeah, protection and put into a binding customs union with Poland. Yeah, so there you go. So it was kind of like, we're going to run it, but it's kind of part of Poland. So after the territorial changes, the next big thing that we want to look at here is the military restrictions, because one of the big things that comes out of the Treaty of Versailles is that their army is destroyed. So the treaty was comprehensive and complex in the restriction imposed on the post-war German armed forces. The provisions were intended to make the Reichswehr incapable of offensive action and encourage international disarmament. So Germany was to demobilize sufficient soldiers by the 31st of March 1920 to leave an army of no more than 100,000 men in a maximum of 7 infantry and 3 cavalry divisions. The treaty laid down the organisation of the divisions and support units, and the general staff was to be dissolved. Military schools for officer training were limited to 3, and conscription was abolished. Private soldiers and NCOs were to be retained for at least 12 years and officers for a minimum of 25 years, with former officers being forbidden to attend military exercises. What's going on with that one? To prevent Germany from building up a large cadre of trained men, the number of men allowed to leave early was limited. Okay, so what they're doing there is they're basically saying, once you're in, you've got to stay in.
Yeah.
Because what we don't want you to do is train a different 100,000 men every year.
Rotating them through.
Yeah. So they're like, oh, if we demobilize Germany, then you know that'll help us disarm across all militaries. Yeah. And meanwhile, Britain are on the side, on the phone to the shipbuilder going, yep, so we're going to need a couple of dozen more dreadnoughts, thanks.
Yeah. I mean, the restrictions for Germany were also like bringing them back to a Napoleonic era war. No ships, no tanks, no submarines, no planes. I think they could have a small amount of Kriegsmarine, and the rest of it was just a tiny amount of infantry for, you know, civil disturbance or whatever. It was really scaled down. And, yeah, like, all the technological aspects that were sort of came into the forefront of World War One were nixed.
Gas,
chemical weapons, tanks, planes, like, submarines, which were all the sort of the big innovations of World War One. You're not allowed any of that.
So, you can have guys with swords on horses.
Yeah.
we'll fight you on that. So the number of civilian staff supporting the army was reduced. The police force was reduced. Increases limited to population increases. Paramilitary forces were forbidden. So the Rhineland was to be demilitarized, or fortifications to be destroyed. Military structures and fortifications in the islands up in the Baltic were to be destroyed. Germany was prohibited from the arms trade. Limits were imposed on the type and quantity of weapons and prohibited from the manufacture or stockpile of chemical weapons, armored cars, tanks, and military aircraft. And this is important because the start of the First World War, Germany is just starting to take over Britain as the world's technological power, and especially in chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, early 20th century German chemistry is the business. And so
a lot of it brought about because of the blockade.
Yeah.
There was the need for nitrates to keep making gunpowder that
and fertilize soil as well.
Was so instrumental in.
Yeah, and so by prohibiting the arms trade, they're basically saying you can't, a lot of the industry that you've been building up.
It's nixing their R&D.
Yeah. The German Navy was allowed 6 pre-dreadnought battleships and was limited to a maximum of 6 light cruisers. So without going into too much detail, 6 pre-dreadnought battleships are going to be useless against a dreadnought. So the Brits are basically saying, we just want to be able to have one ship parked up near Denmark that can keep you all in check. So a few other, 12 destroyers, 12 torpedo boats, and no submarines. And restrictions on how many people they can have in the Navy and all of that. So basically, German industry, German military, all destroyed. And they have to somehow then pay these reparations, which is the next outcome. So Article 231 was, Germany accepted responsibility for the losses and damages caused by the war as a consequence of the aggression of Germany and her allies. The treaty required Germany to compensate the Allied powers and also established an Allied Reparation Commission to determine the exact amount which Germany would pay, which we've gone into before. So about $500 billion in today's money. So we're going to destroy any ability of you to make something that you will be able to sell, and then we're going to ask for all of your money. So essentially the only thing you're going to be able to sell for foreign coin is, we will buy your raw coal and your raw iron ore off you, and the French will then turn that into steel and your grain.
So you mentioned before about German chemistry, and one of Fritz Haber's things after the war was, like, he wanted to save Germany from the treaty through science. And he had heard this statistic somewhere that ocean water contains a certain percentage of gold.
Yeah.
And so he spent a whole heap of time working on this project to extract gold from seawater to pay back the debt. But it turned out that the percentages that he'd heard were completely wrong. And yeah, it got really nowhere.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something going on with that today with rare earth minerals as well.
Yeah, right.
An extraction of from seawater. Yeah. So guarantees to ensure compliance, the Rhineland and bridgeheads of the East Rhine were to be occupied by Allied troops for 15 years. If Germany had not committed aggression, a stage withdrawal would take place after five years. The Cologne bridgehead and the territory north of a line along the Ruhr would be evacuated. And that's where most of the people in Germany live. Is they're saying we're going to occupy that for 15 years. Mm. So that's like, this is not the, you know,
it's not the boonies.
Yeah, no. Like I lived around Cologne for a while, and it's like 12 cities.
Yeah.
In the space of Melbourne, and it's, you know, 8 million people or something in this area. So after 10 years, the bridgehead at Koblenz and the territories to the north would be evacuated. And after 15 years, all Allied forces would be withdrawn. Germany reneged, they would reoccupy immediately. So two more things to talk about, and then we'll finish up. The first is international organizations, and that is the League of Nations and the International Labour Organization. So part one of the treaty, as per all treaties signed during the Paris Peace Conference, was the Covenant of the League of Nations, which provided for the creation of a league, an organization for the arbitration of international disputes. So that's basically the League of Nations. It's not like, it's less ambitious than the UN. The UN sort of is supposed to have what we, I guess, maybe call like legislative ability. Whereas the League of Nations is supposed to just be a deliberative arbitration committee.
Well, it kind of was and it wasn't. That was one of the sort of the problems that the Americans had, was that in the articles of the formation, it gave sovereign powers to the League of Nations. Mm. And so some of the big sort of very typical of the time objections to this was brown people are going to be able to have sovereignty over us. Like small nations will be able to have sovereignty. And the other worry was that it was there was a majority of Catholics. And so they were worried about this like Catholic world order.
Anti-Catholicism is pretty interesting. It always surprises me how unaware people are of Catholics being a separate race to the Anglos, and how the Anglos really treat the Catholics like that. But the other thing I was going to bring up there, because it's not so much till after World War II and the UN that it becomes a big problem, but the UN, the US are really, with the sovereignty idea, the US are really, 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 really worried that there will be some sort of law outlawing apartheid states.
Yeah,
and obviously the US at this stage is an apartheid state, and so they really didn't like that part of it. You know, again, I wish I had my Billy Hughes just jumping and saying no Japs, because I think that would be appropriate now. So then they've also, as part of the League of Nations, they also established the International Labour Officer. So that's about trying to regulate hours of work, and just labor laws, trying to get some sort of universal labor law around, you know, mainly about saying, like, let's not have children working in factories anywhere. So, yeah, it didn't really work, that one. Yeah, and there was a whole lot of other, you know, just, it's like the UN Convention on Human Rights, which pretty much every country has signed. And you go in there and read it, and it's like this country, with all of its wealth, with all of its labor laws, you know, for what they are, is in violation of that treaty so much. Anyway, so just the one last thing is, I wanted to leave the mandates until last, because it is.
Well, it's still with us.
Yeah, and So, Article 119 of the treaty required Germany to renounce sovereignty over former colonies, and Article 22 converted the territories into League of Nations mandates under the control of allied states. So, Togoland and German Cameroon were transferred to France, Rwanda and Burundi are allocated to Belgium, German Southwest Africa goes to South Africa, and the UK get German East Africa. So as compensation for the German invasion of Portuguese Africa, Portugal gets the Kionga Triangle, which is part of German East Africa and northern Mozambique. And German concessions in Shandong, China go to Japan, not to China. And of course, the concessions in China was, Chinese colonialism was basically everyone got there late and at the same time, so they all got little bits of Shanghai to themselves, a few other little possessions, as opposed to taking over the whole country in the more common colonial story. Japan was granted all Germanic possessions in the Pacific north of the equator, and Australia gets all of those south of the equator, except for German Samoa, which goes to New Zealand. So I wanted to finish off with the mandates, because not only because, like you said, we're still living with this today. If you want to know why the Middle East has been the Middle East for the last 60 years, this is a really good place to start.
Yeah, you go back. I mean, you mentioned earlier how Wilson was very upset about the whole secret treaties and things like that. And one of the most famous secret treaties is known as the Sykes-Picot Treaty of 1916.
Yeah.
And that was basically France and Britain working out what to do with Ottoman territory at the end of the war. And so during the war, you had T.E. Lawrence, the famous Lawrence of Arabia, going around in Palestine, well, what used to be Palestine, recruiting Arabs and promising self-determination and nationalism after they help overthrow the British, overthrow the empire, the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
And the Arabs do an incredibly commendable job. They put a much better show in than the Australians did in Gallipoli. But then in the background of this, and even unknown to Lawrence himself, was this Sykes-Picot agreement, which basically divides up the Middle East into a shared protectorates divided between the French and the British.
Yeah, and it's out of this clusterfuck where you end up with
Iran and Iraq and Syria and Lebanon.
Yeah, Kurdistan ends up in four different countries.
And
that is a major course.
And this is despite the fact that the Kurds was promised during the meetings at the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah.
Their own independent state.
Well, isn't the dudes in Lawrence of Arabia that he's isn't that the ones that are famous in that? I think that's the Kurdish tribes.
They're the Arabs.
Arab tribes, okay. Yeah.
Like Omar Sharif writing in.
Of course, out of dividing. So
Once again, more straight lines.
Yeah, more straight lines, and it's divided the Kurds up into a bunch of different countries who treat them differently over different periods of time.
There's also really big divides between Sunnis and Shiites.
Yeah.
Like, it was no attention was paid at all to tribal divisions, to even the Coptic Christians in that area.
The point of the treaty,
exactly,
was to draw lines based on national identity.
Yeah, and this is one of the worst jobs that the Europeans and Americans ever managed to do, I think, as far as keeping people together.
And of course, the whole point of the mandates was that, we can't give these people independence yet, so we'll put them under tutelage. And for example, there was supposed to be a whole lot of... So all of that stuff through Central Europe, that was all supposed to be mandates.
Yeah.
And Wilson went, Europeans can't be... We can't make Europeans mandates. So he was against the idea that you would have the colonial powers teaching Europeans how to be civilized.
Yeah.
But everywhere else in the world, that is more than appropriate. And of course, it goes down. It's different in different places. One of the reasons why post-colonial India has been much more politically stable than say post-colonial Mozambique was because not only was there already an existing sort of power structure there, but there was actually an attempt by the British to to do their duty on this and to start training public servants. Because the whole idea is that you can't just give independence over to a country that you've been running. Because what happens is you take out all of the bureaucracy,
yeah,
and all of the civil service. And if you just remove all of the bureaucracy and civil service from a country, it is going to collapse.
Yeah.
The problem is, if you have been oppressing people and not allowing them to go to school, for example, it's hard to replace that bureaucracy within a generation. And that is the story of post-colonialism.
Yeah.
Basically, is that power vacuums left behind, usually by colonial powers trying to hold on to colonies for too long.
Leave
behind power vacuums and nobody knows how to do anything. So the guy with the most guns.
Well, you look at the collapse of Iraq and Syria.
Yeah.
And interestingly, you end up with ISIS filling up that void. And one of their stated aims was the elimination of the Sykes-Picot Treaty.
Oh, there you go. I didn't know that. Interesting. So there you go. All right. I reckon that's enough for this one. This is the longest podcast of this series by a distance. It's the others aren't going to be quite this long, but this was the big one. Like I said, I'm going to give you a bit more theory in the next ones coming out, just as to what we're doing here. But hopefully what you've gotten out of today is a better understanding of 1919. And I really want you to be thinking about, okay, we are now in a period of great optimism, but also great uncertainty. The idea of the empire is over and the idea of the nation state is coming into power, but we don't know how that's going to go. So that's where I'll leave it today. Thanks for coming along to the Box of Dreams, Ollie.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening. Goodbye. We'll see you next week.
Bloody ball.
The main of every true blue fan is the bad ex-cricketer anchor man. It's the same old words in the same old voice. Long past time, there was another choice, like the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
From the Box of Dreams, you're gonna hear the call. Oh, Bob, bloody ball.